Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Meatball, Vinny Car Wash, Junior Lollipops. We can't get enough of those names. Racketeering, extortion, murder over a spilled drink. Not so funny. But all in last week's big day of mob indictments, it was also out of the blue, so out of the 9/11 terror track we've grown accustomed to, that we wanted to look again, deeper and wider. It's not just La Cosa Nostra out there. We've got Mexican, Albanian, Chinese, Russian organized crime, and groups that don't fit any old pigeonhole. This hour On Point, the FBI's big mob bust, and the wider face and significance of organized crime in America now. In his press conference last Thursday, after the biggest single-day mob takedown in U.S. history, Attorney General Eric Holder emphasized that La Cosa Nostra was still a very real threat.
Today's arrests mark an important and encouraging step forward in disrupting La Cosa Nostra's operations. But the reality is that our battle against organized crime enterprises is far from over. This is an ongoing effort. Members and associates of La Cosa Nostra are among the most dangerous criminals in our country. The very oath of allegiance sworn by these mafia members during their initiation ceremony binds them to a life of crime.
La Cosa Nostra, our thing, sounds like old times. It was last week. Joining me now from New York is Howard Abedinsky, professor of criminal justice and legal studies at St. John's University in New York, former senior parole officer for New York State, author of Organized Crime, about to come out in its 10th edition. Howard Abedinsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And from New York, Mark Feldman. For 30 years, he headed up high-profile organized crime cases as a state and federal prosecutor. He led the multi-agency investigation into the Gambino and Genovese family's grip on the New York waterfront, culminating in the conviction of Gambino boss Peter Gotti. He's now a consultant with BDO Seidman, an accounting consulting firm. Mark Feldman, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Howard, walk us in here. What did you make of the big number of charges, indictments last week?
Well, it was deja vu all over again, as they say.
Yeah?
Almost 2 years to the day, almost 100 reputed mobsters were arrested in a very, very similar circumstances, a giant roundup. The outcome of those cases were not really outstanding. And 2 years later, we have a similar situation of 127. I hope that the outcome is better than the outcome that occurred in 2008.
In terms of the success of those prosecutions, Howard, is this a resurgence of the mafia or something else?
It's a resurgence of FBI and Justice Department interest.
Meaning?
Well, I think the emphasis of the FBI, and rightfully so, has been subsequent to 9/11, has been on terrorism. And I think there was some concern and questions even, I believe, amongst the media that perhaps we, meaning the government, was giving organized crime a pass with its emphasis on terrorism. I think this case is a way of showing that, no, they've not gotten a pass. We just arrested 127 of them. And this will quiet down any criticisms that the FBI certainly has not been looking at organized crime. It gives them another 2 years.
Mark Feldman, we're going to look more widely than La Cosa Nostra, than the mafia here. But what about just in that quarter? What does this tell you? A lot of these charges go way back into the early 80s. A lot of the people arrested were anything but spring chickens, if you look down the list. Does this say it's alive and kicking, or is this rooting around, you know, in history? How do you see it, Mark?
I have a couple of observations. I agree with Professor Abedinsky in that, you know, they're disparate cases and they are they're putting everybody on notice that they're on the field, the FBI is, and that they're policing. There's an important indictment in the group of indictments that come out. It's the Colombo family indictment. And if you're looking to, there has been over the past 20 years, as Professor Abedinsky pointed out, multiple indictments involving all sorts of racketeering charges across all the five families. And the interesting thing is that the five families are still viable. They are very, very weak. They're back to bread and butter racketeering. But there are, they need to continue to be police, because the one thing I can tell you with absolute certainty is if they are not policed, they have the ability to regenerate and to grow. So I think it's an important step that the Bureau and the various offices took. I also note that several districts were involved. You have the Southern District, Eastern District, District of New Jersey, all bringing cases, as well as Rhode Island. And that's also something that doesn't happen. Some people want to say it's a little bit of a splash, but I think what it is with some limited resources, the FBI and the prosecutor saying to these gangs, we're out there, we're looking at you, and we're still coming at you.
The mafia, now we'll look more broadly here, but the mafia is still very much, maybe more than ever, New York-centered with the five families. First of all, you mentioned Mark Feldman, the Genovese, Gambino, Colombo, Lucchese, Bonanno. Howard Abedensky, if it's back to bread-and-butter racketeering, when you look through this big, fat stack of charges, what's the most of it about? What's the biz these days?
I've looked through all of the indictments to try to find something that was a new wrinkle in the portfolio of organized crime in New York and, of course, New England and the New Jersey family. This is the same old portfolio. I agree with Mark. These are dangerous people. And if the government doesn't continue to investigate them and prosecute them, I think that they will grow stronger. It's the only organized crime group, the only criminal organization of any substance that has the very wide portfolio of activities. You can talk about, you mentioned, I believe, some of the Mexican groups. They are one-trick ponies. They do drugs. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about the American mafia, you're talking about people that interfere with business. They interfere with labor. They present a much more serious threat than the so-called emerging groups, who for the most part are one-trick ponies.
Put some meat on those bones. Business, labor, if you look at these indictments, what's in there? I mean, we heard about putting the squeeze on strip clubs. Bizarre, but in 2010, there's still a big influence on the waterfront in New York and maybe New Jersey. What else is in there?
Well, you find the influence on the waterfront. That's quite important. I mean,
sure.
That's our commerce. That's our trade.
And our security.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, our security. So if you're still having organized crime influence and power on the waterfront, that's a very, very serious problem. You also see that they've got influence, and that's part of the indictment, in one of the major construction unions. Construction is a very, very important industry in New York City. If you can exercise control over a construction union, you, in fact, can dictate the terms of how much it costs to put a building up in New York, how much it costs to put up a skyscraper. You're affecting commerce, and that affects, you know, every New Yorker, and in fact goes way beyond New York in terms of the expense to business and indirectly to the expense to all of us.
Mark Feldman, it may have come as a surprise to a lot of people, but I don't know, if you're in the waterfront union business in New York or in construction or maybe in other businesses, is this well known to people? Does everybody know it's out there, you've got to deal with it? Or was it surprising even in those quarters?
I think that it was well known 15 or 20 years ago. There have been a variety of mechanisms put into place that go hand in glove with what the government and what state and federal prosecutors were doing. The concept, which is very robust in the metropolitan area of monitorships, where the expenditures of where unions that have been mob infiltrated are being monitored by outside mechanisms. Also, the monitoring of large construction projects, for example, the rebuilding of Ground Zero and the Freedom Tower, recognize the reality. And what they are, again, is are part of a panorama of efforts to reduce the influence of these gangs. The genius of the enterprises, when you look at their history, is that they grew up with this country, so to speak, and they've infiltrated those unions and those industries that are very, very vital to the, you know, the lifeblood and the commerce of the city as well as to the country. And but what you're seeing, and I thought the one embarrassing charge in there basically was that there was a charge of the Colombo family extorting the Gambino family, which I guess is legally apt, but kind of an odd kind of situation to be in, but legally correct. So what you have is people know about this. There's been robust policing and robust. A lot of people have been thinking about how to reduce their influence, and I think the kind of charges is what Professor Abedinsky is talking about. The kind of that there's nothing new is very good news, because you don't have the quality, sophisticated leadership that you had 25 years ago, and you also don't have the type of behavior where in a bug in the Palmer Boys Social Club in East Harlem, Fat Tony Salerno says, that union is mine. You don't have that type of reality anymore, and I think that as the years go by, that will continue to be reduced by these sorts of efforts.
Here's a little bit from Goodfellas. Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, explains what it means to be a made man.
Jimmy and I could never be made because we had Irish blood. It didn't even matter that my mother was Sicilian. To become a member of a crew, you've got to be 100% Italian so they can trace all your relatives back to the old country. See, it's the highest honor they can give you. Means you belong to a family and a crew.
Goodfellas, 1990. Howard Abedinsky, who's in the mafia today? And does it still have to be, you know, traced back to the old country? Is it still like that?
It certainly wasn't that way in Chicago, where there were members of the Chicago outfit who had one parent of Italian heritage, and that was seen as sufficient. I think what's happening is that the prospects, the critical mass of individuals who might be eligible for, you know, membership as a result of their Italian heritage, obviously are not interested in going into organized crime. I mean, they're my colleagues at the university. They're sitting on the United States Supreme Court.
Sure.
They're the governor of New York. They don't need to go in.
So who's in there? Who's doing this now?
People who watch The Sopranos too much. I'm being a little bit glib. But you've got young people out there who are not looking necessarily for the money. Their parents can send them to college. They can help them establish a business. These are individuals who enjoy the romance, romanticization of the mob, the subcultural aspects of it, the hanging around, being a tough guy, beating people up, getting the kind of street respect that they enjoy that you see on The Sopranos. And it gets promoted on television by programs like The Sopranos. They keep the myth of the mafia alive and attracts a certain element, a very small element within the Italian community who want to still be part of the American mafia.
Mark Feldman, in these indictments, there were something like 30 so-called made men. What does it mean that there were just 30? And who are all the other people, if not, you know, made men, members?
Well, typically, you have to... They shield themselves from activity, and they're obviously harder to investigate and prosecute. You would typically see more, more associates than you would see made individuals.
Arrested because the made ones are what pulling the strings. They keep the distance.
They keep their distance. The structure is very. Very conventional. There's a captain. The captain has one to a number of soldiers. The soldiers have one to many associates beneath them. So from the standpoint of the way this is structured, that's what you would expect. It's significant that many made people are being charged. And also captains and administration personnel are very significant, obviously, because that truly disrupts the command and control of the enterprise.
I want to get to some of our callers. Let's go to, if I may, let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Tom. What's your question?
Hello. my question is I understand that the apprehension of these people. Now, my experience of witnessing what goes on through the courts is there's always a lot of plea bargaining, and there's you know, even if there are trials, will there be, with your panel's legal experience, will there be many convictions?
Howard Abedinsky, what do you say? I heard your note of skepticism earlier.
Well, a skepticism on one hand in terms of 127 people and whether or not there'll be significant penalties that get handed down. But in general, the FBI, the Justice Department, has been tremendously successful in using the RICO statute, which brings 20 years or more on several different counts, and very, very successful in putting away for very long periods of time members of organized crime. That's one of the reasons why you have so many informants. I mean, as part of this case, somebody was wearing a wire, probably more than one person. And that person was wearing a wire to get information about his colleagues because he was probably facing a very, very long prison sentence.
With that kind of threat, though, why hasn't it gone away? Will it go away this time? 127 is a big number.
It won't go away because, as I pointed out, as long as you have young people who romanticize the mob, who want to be a wise guy, want to be like a Henry Hill, and want to get into the subculture that we know is organized crime, then organized crime, in fact, will be able to replicate itself and will continue indefinitely.
John in Danielson, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Well, good.
Hi, John.
Tom, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What are you thinking?
What has happened to Gambino Jr.? Because he was acquitted twice, and the government didn't know what to do the last I heard whether or not to retry him. Is he among the arrested in this roundup?
I don't know. Gambino Jr.? I mean, the Gambino clan, famous for John Gotti. What about Gambino?
I mean, John Gotti Jr., yeah.
Oh, okay. Howard?
John, no Gotti is mentioned in any of the indictments.
I mean, the Gotti, you know, the kids have been on reality TV. They look like they're out of the business.
It looks like you've got... You've got life copying art and art copying life. It's hard to see which, you know, where organized crime begins and fictionalization ends. It's become part of entertainment, and it's correct. It's very, very hard to tell if we're talking about criminals or we're talking about actors with all this reality TV.
You know, I want to ask, we've got a lot of comments online from people saying, like, here's Gail, who says there have been no Wall Street prosecutions on the financial economic meltdown. Double standard at the U.S. Department of Justice and FBI look the other way at white-collar crime explains why our country is now considered economically a third-world economy. Paolo says the FBI are a bunch of phonies if they really think they should be proud of these. He calls them pathetic busts. Put down the donuts and the Gambino flowcharts and go after Wall Street and war criminals. I don't know, Mark, there's a feeling abroad in the land that it's not just the mob that needs attention here. What about where the FBI's resources are focused these days?
Well, I think the FBI's resources, and I'm certainly not an expert on where it is at the moment, but I feel fairly confident that if you had to prioritize, obviously you have Homeland Security and terrorism, and you have white collar. And I think that one of the reasons for the arrests in this fashion is because that's not their priority right now, organized crime. That's a homegrown problem that I think that they feel, and I'm not speaking for anybody but my sense of it, they feel they can deal with. And I think if they had their druthers, they'd put more agents into the field because, bottom line, they haven't killed a family yet. Remember, though, that at the time the strike forces were developed, when Robert Kennedy formulated the concept to really attack organized crime,
yep,
there were organized crime families in 24 cities, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And it has become, if you're down to really the metropolitan area, a little bit of New England and Chicago, for the most part, you have, you know, some disparate groups here and there. Anything that's going to happen go forward is going to come out of the Northeast, basically.
But, of course, there's a lot of other action around the country. We'll talk about that. But what about where the resources went after 9/11, Howard? You know, we heard what in Ben Affleck's recent film, The Town, about bank robbery and all. You hear the FBI saying, boy, if there was anything to do with, I don't know, Islamic terrorism, one little whiff of it, we could have all kinds of agents on this case. How much got shifted? You know, how much was the pool drained of people focused on organized crime?
Well, what I would just venture a guess, and I think rightfully so, that the FBI was shifting its resources to terrorism. I think it's a much more obvious problem that has to be dealt with. It's a threat to national security. I would like to say, however, in response to an earlier caller, that in more recent years, certainly in the last decade, the FBI and the Justice Department have been doing quite an outstanding job dealing with corporate crime, something which they had not dealt with in earlier decades, and they've done a what I think is quite a marvelous job. So I don't think that they're letting a corporate crime simply go without attention being paid to it. I think the concern here is that with the emphasis on corporate crime, and certainly the rightfully so, the emphasis on Homeland Security, that somehow the American Mafia, La Cosa Nostra, would grow stronger again. And so they can't completely give up dealing with that entity. But that entity is certainly not as important as dealing with corporate crime or dealing certainly with Homeland Security.
Let's go to Joe in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to say I really think that I've been listening to you, and I really think you people are covering the bases in such a short period of time. You're doing real well. This is what I think I can add after listening to
okay.
you, because I agree with a fair amount was said, but it has been said. I believe we need the federal U.S. Marshals to go after the syndicate. I feel that they're much more honest and above the table. I don't have so much faith in the FBI to go after them. We already know that they were involved with the Irish Mafia up in the Northeast here. Get the federal U.S. Marshals involved. And I'm very impressed that you realize all the different mafias that have been coming up, because I believe that we have different ethnic groups, and it's starting to change a little bit less your ethnic background and a little bit more, other reasons or what's forming these illegal groups that are preying on people. Wherever there's poor people, areas that have been oppressed, the poor neighborhoods, you're going to have some kind of a syndicate that's going to take over.
Hey, Joe, let us jump in right there, if we may, because you give us an opening to this bigger picture, and I want to get there. I appreciate your call very much, Joe. Jay Albanese joins us now from Washington, criminologist, professor of government public policy at Virginia Commonwealth University, author and editor of 15 books, including Transnational Crime in the 21st Century, Organized Crime in Our Times. Jay Albanese, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
I'm looking at a big Congressional Research Service report about organized crime in this country. And the mafia, Italian is on there, as they put it, but they've also got Russian, Asian, Balkan, Middle Eastern, African. I mean, how does the mafia, fit into the bigger organized crime picture these days, Jay?
Well, it is quite interesting. What has in fact happened is that there has been a shift. We didn't go after mafia-linked organized crime in a very big way until the mid-80s, and the prosecution effort of the last 25 years has been substantial. But also in the last 25 years, we've had the collapse of the Soviet Union, the rise of all these emerging democracies around the world, ease of international travel, the rise of the Internet. All these things create opportunities for criminal activity, and a lot of those opportunities exist overseas as well as within the U.S.
So if you make a pie chart of organized crime activity in the U.S., how big are the different slices? How big is the mafia compared to Mexican, let's say, doing drugs, or Russian doing trafficking? I don't know what kind of stuff. Or Balkan, Albanian. How's it break down? Do we know?
Yes, we do know, because if you track prosecutions by the government, you will see now that non-Italian, the non-Cosa Nostra organized crime groups are now a minority of the federal organized crime prosecutions.
Wait, the non are a minority, or the Italian is a minority?
The Italian groups are now the minority of federal organized crime prosecutions.
Okay. So are they really all different businesses? Are there different complexions to the activity of different groups? And is it all ethnically based still?
No, it isn't all ethnically based. A couple of things are happening. Most of the organized crime prosecutions and activity is around products. It's around drug markets. It's around illegal gambling, stolen property, trafficking in human beings, this kind of thing. And when you look at how these groups are, in fact, organized, increasingly they are networked as opposed to social groups. For example, when you think of classic cases, John Gotti and his number two guy, Sammy Gravano, they had a social relationship apart from crime, a lot like these guys mentioned in the current indictment. That is, even if they didn't engage in crimes together, They ate pasta together, drank wine together, smoked yep. cigars together, went to each other's weddings, all this kind of thing. Their business just happened to be crime. Increasingly, you see that groups are more networks as opposed to groups. So criminals organize around opportunities rather than organized as a social group. So, Tom, if I was disposed to commit crime and you were good at counterfeiting documents, okay. I might mm-hmm. bring you on. And if I needed a guy who could drive a tractor trailer, I might know through some guy I know at the bar to do that. And you have a growing number of these kind of networks that come together around an opportunity, and they might not continue. We might never work again.
So it could be one-time kind of contract out of a specific skill. Let me, if I may, put it to you, Howard, does that sort of crimp the growth now of the mafia itself? If it's still got a, you know, sort of Italian heritage requirement, is that a unique characteristic now of that group, Howard?
Well, I would suggest to you, first of all, that every member, every so-called made guy in organized crime has a constellation around him, a network of people. That individual, this made guy, facilitates an enormous amount of crime. Even though he might not participate directly in it, yep. he facilitates it. And part of the networks that you're talking about, oftentimes there is a made guy who's part of it. If they're going to somebody who has certain kind of skills, if they're looking for somebody who's with certain kind of criminal skills, you go to the made guy, and he'll find somebody. He'll know somebody that has those kinds of skills, has those kinds of weapons, has whatever it is that's necessary.
And whoever they may be, whatever ethnicity, whatever background, is that the way it works?
That's correct. That's correct. So what you have is, if you have 200 members of an organized crime family, each one of those individuals, in fact, is facilitating dozens and dozens of crimes. You do the math, you'll find out it's thousands of crimes that they may not be directly participating in, but they are facilitating those crimes, and therefore they are quite dangerous.
And the made guys, again, just to be very clear, is it something singular to the mafia that they have to have a particular ethnic, you know, background?
Howard? In order to perform this?
Well, to be made, I mean...
Oh, yes. Yes.
Jay, what about outside the mafia? I mean, you're talking about something that sounds looser out there, where it's not necessarily... I mean, Howard points out, you know, they've got a constellation of people around them, even within the mafia. Are other groups even less ethnically based or not?
Yes, simply because to pull off scams, you don't want to be as organized around one particular thing. So if your game is human trafficking, well, you need somebody to help recruit. The victims are often in a different location, sometimes a different country. You need somebody at the border to facilitate the crossing. You need somebody on the delivery end that actually handles the transportation to exploit the victims. So it's increasingly scams are beyond the capacity of a single group to control. And this holds true for drug trafficking and international frauds, this kind of thing.
This is really interesting stuff. Jay Albanese, please stick with us in Washington. Howard Abedinsky in New York. Please stand by. Mark Feldman at BDO Consulting, joining us today from New York, former state and federal prosecutor. Mark, thank you very much for your insights today.
You're very welcome, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biggest one-day mob bust in history, we're told, and the face of organized crime in America. Now, it's a lot more than the Cosa Nostra. And Howard, Jay, lots of interesting questions here. Here's Cyril in Providence, Rhode Island, says, you know, the guys are here. They're not trying to hide it either. I've seen guys in suits and haircuts and look like you'd swear they'd traveled in time. Another one from Rhode Island, interesting. And they're, of course, big bust touched Providence as well. Victoria says, I work for a startup seafood company selling to Providence and Boston restaurants. We couldn't sell a single shrimp on Federal Hill in Providence. We got turned down everywhere. Chef owner said incredulously, are you kidding me? I have a restaurant on Federal Hill. I have only one choice of seafood vendor. I wish I could, but if I buy from you guys, I'm in big trouble. Howard, is that the way it works? Howard, are you there, my friend? Jay, are you with me? Do you hear the story?
Yes,
is that the way it goes?
That's the way it works in certain neighborhoods around the country. And I think, you know, the current indictments are a useful reminder that, you know, organized crime still exists and, you know, we ignore it at our own risk.
Here's another one from James who says, this past weekend, millions of Americans participated in illegal betting on football playoff games. This is a great source of revenue for the mob. The media in America participate in this crime by publishing odds to all the games. What about sports gambling and the mob now, Jay?
Well, when you look at it, organized crime groups, Italian and otherwise, are organized around making a quick profit. These people do not want to go to work in the morning like you and I. They want to make money quick, fast, and illegally. So organized crime groups primarily engage in catering to the American demand for drugs, illegal gambling, sex, stolen property, and cash. So the point is, I am not surprised at all. And even though the prosecution effort against the mob has been dramatically successful over the last 25 years, the reason we see arrests last week is simply because these markets still exist. So even if you prosecute a group out of existence entirely, which in fact we have in the U.S. in several cities, there's still a demand for drugs and gambling and these things. So other folks emerge to, in fact, cater to that demand.
Let's get a call from Rock Island, Illinois. Kim's calling. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Well, hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Actually, listening to you guys, I get this feeling that Prohibition and the Great Depression and the War on Drugs and this great ugly recession we've got going on right now are totally connected. I mean, you're taking all this money out of people want things, and they're going to get it. I mean, like the war on drugs, they have proven time and time again that people who have drug problems, it's a medical issue, not a criminal issue. So throwing people in jail isn't going to change it. And like you said, you're opening up this huge market for all this
business.
Illegal money.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's taking money out of the actual economy because everybody's wanting to get into that. They've already legalized gambling in most states, and of course, at the same time, being from Illinois, I laugh because the money was supposed to go to schools in the road, and you know how Illinois is going right now. We're so far behind on everything, so everything goes into a slush fund. So once again, I mean, there's corruption all across the board. But wouldn't it be better and easier for the police and everybody else if we made drugs and prostitution legal, figure out who has problems with it, get them medical help.
And get an open handle on it that way. Kim, I appreciate your call. Let me put it to Howard. Howard Abedinsky, are you there? Kim makes an interesting point, you know. We think about organized crime, the mafia, we think back to Prohibition and the Great Depression, and here we are with great big prohibitions on drug use and a pretty decent near depression. Does that put us back in, organized crime friendly territory?
It is parallel. There is a parallelism here. The organized crime that we're talking about today, in fact, developed out of Prohibition. When Prohibition ended, all of the organizations that Prohibition had served to create simply continued and moved on to other areas of crime. It's correct. I mean, we could do away with an awful lot of crime tomorrow if we certainly legalized all of the drugs which are now prohibited. But I think we have to also consider the kind of social problems that would create, and that's a big unknown.
Hey, Jay, here's a note on the web from Bill who says, "Hey, let's look at Mexican drug trafficking." He says these organizations collect tens of billions of dollars in revenue every year, control whole swaths of Mexican and Central American territory, continue to use escalating levels of violence. There's a real threat to national security. And by the way, he reports they've got some pretty good nicknames too. His favorite being El Winnie Pooh. What about, pull the curtain back a little wider here in terms of impact, Jay. Start with Mexican.
Oh, sure. You don't have to read very far into the newspaper to see the level of violence going on there, and that's primarily because the government in Mexico is taking on the drug gangs, which I think is a very good sign. However, keep in mind, the other half of that is that given the size and power of the drug gangs in Mexico, most of the drugs that they're selling to people in the United States. So in some ways, the U.S. is in fact complicit in manufacturing that high demand that helps sustain these gangs.
They're mainly into drugs. What about other groups? I don't know, if you look at Russian, let's say, or Chinese, do they have specialties, Jay?
Yes, although you can't break it down by ethnic or national boundaries. So, for example, there's been made cases involving a trafficking of human beings, which generally occurs from developing countries to developed countries. trafficking of false products, counterfeit products, anything that you can make a fast profit off of. All you need is really a way to get it across the border, whether it's a human being or a product, and you can make money because there's many people on the demand end willing to look the other way and buy whatever you're selling.
And is everybody involved in everything, or does it break down? I mean, I take your point that it's no longer the strict sort of ethnic clubs, and yet there seem to be at least an ethnic complexion to different groups here.
Yes, there are, simply because when you're engaged in illegal activity, you tend to have to stick with people who you can trust, and those tend to be the folks closest to you. So it isn't surprising that they are primarily people of backgrounds similar to yours.
Let's go to Tony in New York City. Tony, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
Pretty well. What do you know?
I got to tell you, when you look back at, you know, talking about the romance of being the allure of being in a group, understood with certain genres of ethnicity, whether it's Albanian, Italian, Irish, it becomes the core of the essence of the street. But when you go back to the late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, early 80s, when there was a wire room, a bookmaker, an X, Y, or Z, and then you get the city coming through, legalizing the number, the lotto, taking the money from, you know, grandma and a, you know, Social Security, who's the bad guy there? And they're saying it goes to education, it goes to the schools. You know, I still don't see, you know, schools that are looking like brand new.
Yeah.
In the city.
Yeah.
All that lotto money goes to the schools. If they want to point to the quote-unquote, you know, vicious bad guy, they should start from the top down when it comes to politics.
Tony, I appreciate your call. Howard, how about that? I mean, has the is the government in effect moved in?
I have a very, very bad taste in my mouth when it comes to the government promoting gambling. I don't think the government should have a role in promoting things, in fact, that are very disastrous for certain people. So I really do object to the extensive use of advertisement to get people to gamble. If we could say anything nice about organized crime, they didn't advertise. They didn't try to encourage people to gamble. If you wanted to gamble, they provided opportunity, but they didn't go out to encourage it. They didn't advertise it on radio, on television, on billboards.
Right now, the government's got billboards up for it. Bill in Manchester, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for the show. This is really the best laugh I think I'm going to get this whole month.
Okay.
This guy they arrested, Louis Minucci or whatever his name was, down in Florida, he was 83.
Former head of the Providence gang, I guess, yeah.
Right. Now, is this guy a threat? I mean, if he goes out, what is he doing? Wearing Depends? Did he forget to put his dentures in before he went to shake somebody down? I mean, you know, the best thing is I'm going to get to work on a screenplay with De Niro and Pacino as two old geezers who are still trying to be mafioso at 85.
Yeah, it's true. We said it right at the top. There's a lot of very elderly busts here, guys in the bus. So what does it say to you, Bill?
It's a joke. What it says to me is that the banks and the mortgage writers and the stockbrokers are really the organized criminals, and they're enabled by the government, okay? I'm not afraid of the mafia. I'm afraid of what my government's going to do to my money, all right? I'll give you another piece of theater and comedy. During, I think it was, I don't know if it's the Reagan administration or one of the Bush administrations, it was Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General.
Yep.
I taped this because it was hilarious. Remember Cheech and Chong?
Of course.
The comedians?
Pass the bong, yeah.
One of them was selling bongs on the Internet. They had to go pick up a backwater Attorney General from Missouri, someone from Deliverance Country over there, to do a dog and pony show on television. Arresting either Cheech and Chong for selling bongs. If these people are protecting me, God, I want to go live in the mountains by myself, because these people, attorney generals and government, they should be maybe looking into some of the lawyers who got off for waterboarding people. Maybe they should be looking into some of the other corrupt officials in government.
Yeah, Bill, I appreciate your call. People raising families everywhere in this country, but I've got, there is an element here that you look at those ages and you think, what does that mean? I mean, Howard, is it worth arresting a guy who's 83 years old? Does it,
if that 83-year-old guy can give an order and have a 25-year-old guy carry out a murder.
You think that's still happening? Is that clear?
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of these charges go back. I mean, the spilled drink murder goes back to 1981.
That's correct. But this 80-year-old guy has the influence and the ability to have, in fact, people involved in all kinds of criminal activity. Besides which, he himself was probably involved in murders, very, very serious crimes, and I don't think we should give that person a pass.
Let's go to Jack in Nashville, Tennessee. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would like to offer the thought that we just had the greatest criminal fraud in the history of the world on Wall Street, and nothing is being done. At this time, after the SNL crisis, over 1,200 indictments had been handed down. And this is a national security threat. Our country has been devastated. There are people out of work. There are people who have lost their homes, illegally, I might add. So we have a wave of crime that is unprecedented in the history of our country. And not to say that the mob shouldn't be gone after.
Yep.
But this is petty change compared to the truth of what we're actually dealing with.
Jack, I appreciate your call as well. Jay, it's coming in waves here. I don't know what it was like in the 1930s. I mean, there were certainly more arrests then in the Depression on the white collar side. But you hear this anger with, hey, they're going after the mob, and maybe so. But boy, people are looking right at the top of the economic chain.
Well, let's put it this way. Expectations of law enforcement have never been higher. And I wouldn't be surprised in a year or two. There's already been several major indictments involving the mortgage industry. And I wouldn't be surprised that within the next year or so, we see a whole slew more. I just hope people don't call in and say, why are we ignoring organized crime? The point I'm making is that given the competing demands of organized crime, corporate crime, terrorism, the expectations of agencies like the FBI and the Justice Department have never been higher. And if you follow what their actual resources are, I don't think it hasn't grown in any dramatic fashion whatsoever. So it is difficult to keep it all in perspective, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a number of active prosecutions over the next year or so.
Howard, in these indictments, the Wall Street troubles seem to have created opportunities as well. I mean, there's mortgage scams in here. There's, as always, loan sharking that looks like it's related to the economic meltdown.
Yes, I've read all of the indictments, and what I was looking for was something new in the portfolio, you know, given what's going on, you know, on Wall Street. And we do know there have been people in the organized crime families who have been involved in Medicare and Medicaid fraud,
yep.
Have been involved in Internet-related fraud, cybercrime. But I don't see any of this in any of the indictments, and that, quite frankly, surprised me.
What do you think about the proportion, where the weight of prosecution's going these days? We've got callers here saying, you know, go after the guys that took down the economy, not the guys sort of playing down in the rubble. What do you think about that, Howard?
I think that there is an emphasis that might be in disagreement here. I don't think that we can give the mob a pass, because if you do that, if we've done it in the past, it will grow and it'll become more dangerous. And as I indicated earlier, it's the only one, the only criminal organization that has a wide portfolio that can affect interstate commerce. It can affect our shipping industry. It can affect business very directly, like the construction business. So I think we do have to concentrate on organized crime, but certainly not to concentrate on organized crime at the expense of dealing with terrorism or even at the expense of dealing with corporate crime.
How much does 127 names on the list here, Howard, how much does that set back the mob?
I think it creates openings. Certainly the 30-some-odd made guys, if they get taken out, and there's a question whether they'll be taken out, other than very, very briefly, which is what occurred back in 2008. But if it actually creates openings, it's something that the wannabes that have been looking to move into organized crime as made guys, I say, damn, this is wonderful. This is creating opportunity for them. So I'm not quite sure what the impact is going to be. There'll be an impact that occurs immediately, but the long-term impact may, in fact, bring new blood into organized crime, and it certainly is going to strengthen organized crime. It's not going to harm it.
Jay, if we come back in 20 years, are we still going to be talking about this kind of crime, this kind of organizations?
Oh, sure we are. Simply because what we're going to, the only difference is going to be the kinds of crimes that they are committing. Because all of these groups, whether it's mafia groups or other groups, they all organize around criminal opportunities. So whether it's drugs, gambling, sex, stolen property, or stock frauds, trafficking in human beings, or counterfeiting, as long as opportunities are there, criminal groups are going to arise around those opportunities.
Well, we're grateful to the two of you for helping us get the big picture today on this. It's a really, really interesting. Jay Albany is author of Transnational Crime in the 21st Century at Virginia Commonwealth University. Jay, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Howard Abedinsky, Organized Crime, Law and Justice, his books. He's at St. John's University in New York. Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Be safe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.